California Governor Jerry Brown has taken controversial action on water, telling cities and towns to reduce usage by 25% over the next 9 months. I'm Steve Goldstein. On today's Here and Now, we'll look at what that could mean for Arizona in the short and long terms. Will the historic drought lead to water cutbacks here? Does California's dire situation mean it'll need to claim more of its Colorado River allotment, potentially putting Arizona in a more difficult position? Plus, Arizona State hired a new men's basketball coach, former Duke University legend Bobby Hurley. The school's baseball program is ranked in the top 10 nationally, and Sun Devil Stadium is getting a makeover. We'll find out from Vice President of Athletics Ray Anderson where the momentum is coming from and whether it's sustainable. And one of Arizona's unofficial historians, Bob Bose Bell of True West Magazine, joins me to talk about some of the state's Western legends, not all of which are exactly true. Here and Now is next on KJZZ. The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. A small helicopter has landed on the west lawn of the U.S. Capitol. Its pilot has been detained. Nearby streets have been sealed off while police investigate the motive. The FBI and New York Police Department are asking the public to help them figure out who bombed a Times Square military recruitment station in 2008. They're offering a six-figure reward for any information that leads to a conviction. NPR's Dina Temple-Rassen reports authorities believe that attack may be tied to two other bombings in New York.
Authorities have a videotape of the 2008 bombing. A suspect in a gray sweatshirt gets off a bicycle near the recruiting station on West 43rd, places an explosive device by the entrance, lights a fuse, and then flees. Moments later, there's an explosion. Police say the device was built with ammunition commonly found on the battlefields in Iraq and Afghanistan, and they've offered up to $115,000 to anyone with information that leads to a conviction in the case. Dina Temple-Raston, NPR News, New York.
Former New England Patriots star tight end Aaron Hernandez has been convicted of first-degree murder in the 2013 death of Odin Lloyd, who was dating the sister of Hernandez's fiancée at the time. Hernandez has been sentenced to life in prison without parole. His attorney's appealing. Hillary Clinton is wrapping up her two-day campaign kickoff in Iowa. The Democratic presidential contender has been sticking to smaller events in her campaign's bid to tamp down expectations of her image as one of the most powerful figures in politics. Clinton, a former Secretary of State, U.S. Senator, and First Lady, is trying to reintroduce herself to voters as in touch with everyday Americans concerned about job growth and higher wages. President Obama's message today is directed to working women. He delivers remarks at a town hall in Charlotte, North Carolina, this hour as part of his attempt to drum up public support for his proposed budget. Ben Bradford from member station WFAE has the latest.
In Charlotte, the president will take part in a town hall style event with women in blogging and social media. There, he'll call for the expansion of the child care and the earned income tax credits, both of which primarily affect lower and middle income families. Lisa Stone, co-founder of the site Blog Her, will moderate. Stone says the audience won't be limited to those topics.
They will ask their questions themselves if they're called upon by either me or President Obama. These questions will not be vetted in advance. They will not be known in advance.
Stone expects questions about equal pay, work schedules, and maternity leave. President Obama's push for the tax credits comes as Democrats look to make income inequality a campaign issue. For NPR News, I'm Ben Bradford in Charlotte.
At last check on Wall Street, Dow is up more than 100 points at 18,138. S&P 500 up 14, more than 0.5% at 2110. NASDAQ also up more than 0.5% at 5,015. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Roth Family Foundation, investing in organizations that inspire hope, dignity, and creativity. Working to connect communities to the services, opportunities, and tools for self-empowerment and self-expression. Learn more at RothFamilyFoundation.org.
Good morning from KJZZ News in Phoenix. I'm Bruce Drummond. If you want to buy a packet of powder you can mix with water to make an alcoholic drink, you will likely be able to do it in Arizona. A Valley-based company got federal permission to manufacture the product, which can create five different types of drink. But state lawmakers, fearing the product could be abused, voted last month to ban its sale in Arizona. Governor Doug Ducey yesterday rejected that idea, with press aide Daniel Scarpinato saying he still wants palcohol monitored for health and safety.
It doesn't appear at this time to be evidence that this is necessary. So what the governor's done is instructed the Department of Liquor Licenses to ensure that this this new product is being regulated the same way that any other alcohol is.
Scarpinato says that means ensuring it's not sold to minors or people who are obviously intoxicated. After approval from the state, the product could be available in Arizona later this year, unless legislation introduced in Washington bans it nationwide. Arizona Schools Chief Diane Douglas is setting up a committee to review the state's education code. Douglas says the state's education laws fill a 1,000-page volume and are in need of a review. She wants the committee to look for outdated, unnecessary, or harmful sections of the code. The group will make recommendations that can be forwarded to the legislature for action next year.
From the KJZZ Newsroom, I'm Kathy Ritchie. 12 activists who blocked two buses carrying immigrants to federal court in Tucson have been found guilty of obstructing a highway and public nuisance. A Pima County judge had dismissed four other charges against the activists in March. The activists were among 20 others who blocked the buses by lying in front of them and chaining themselves to the tires in 2013. The 12 will be sentenced July 20th.
It'll be sunny and breezy today in the valley. We're looking for a high of 87 degrees. More sunshine tomorrow with a high of just 78.
KJZZ is supported by the Greater Phoenix Chamber of Commerce. Arizona Speakers Forum presents Mexico Now, Energy Opportunities with the Powerhouse Next Door, April 30th. Tickets at phoenixchamber.com/Mexico.
Under mostly sunny skies, we have 77 degrees in Phoenix at 11:06.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Coming up this hour, one of the fiercest critics of cuts to Arizona's public universities has been appointed as the director of the State Department of Agriculture. Supporters of the appointment say Mark Killian is highly qualified, but others are wondering about the timing. We'll talk about that. Also, is opposition getting more attention and gaining more traction in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints? We'll learn more about what happened at the church's recent national conference. We'll also talk with ASU's Vice President of Athletics, Ray Anderson. We start today's program with a look at that most precious of commodities in the desert, water. A little over a week ago, California Governor Jerry Brown announced that state needed to make major cutbacks in water usage to deal with the effects of drought. How could that impact Arizona? How's Arizona dealing with drought? And are we on the verge of having to cut back on how much water we use? With me to talk about that and other topics is Rita McGuire, former director of the Arizona Department of Water Resources and now a practicing water attorney representing, among others, the state of Arizona, private water providers and individual landowners, and Dave White, senior sustainability scientist at ASU's Global Institute of Sustainability. He's also co-director of the Decision Center for a Desert City. Welcome to you both.
Thank you, Steve. Good to be here.
Thank you, Steve.
Rita, let me start off with you. Before we get into Arizona's level of preparation, how significant is this action by California to Arizona's short and long-term water future? Can it affect us directly?
It can't affect us directly, but it is significant. It's the first real step that California has taken to impose mandatory conservation requirements, in particular on municipal water providers. However, I would say it's an executive order, so no one knows exactly how it's going to play out. The agencies themselves at the local level will actually decide how those conservation orders are imposed.
Was this controversial in your mind? It is to many others, but when you heard about it, was it something that was surprising?
No, if anything, the folks in the water business here sort of chuckled to themselves. California, frankly, is a day late and a dollar short. Arizona adopted the Groundwater Management Act in 1980, so 30-plus years ago. And in that act, we have embedded conservation requirements for municipal, industrial, and agricultural water users.
I wonder, going forward, let's talk a little bit about the Colorado River, because I think when people think about where Arizona is at compared to California, where does Arizona stand in terms of where its water usage goes? California, I know, has senior rights, but what does that really mean?
What that means is when Mother Nature is not as generous as we'd like her to be, California gets the first right to divert water off the system. So if you think of it as a bathtub, and the bathtub gets filled with water, California has a big bucket, and they can scoop their allocation out first. If there's not enough water in the bathtub, then those junior right holders, Arizona is an example, go without or have less water to use.
Dave White, let me come to you on your reaction to Jerry Brown's actions in California. Is that something that Arizona needs to keep a very close eye on?
Yes, absolutely. As Rita mentioned, the reductions that California is imposing now are partially the result of a lack of foresight and planning over the prior decades. Arizona has invested quite a bit of energy and attention into managing our groundwater and surface water rights and have enacted fairly progressive policies
to ensure conservation across multiple sectors. It's important for us to watch the situation in California because we are all in this together. While this does not affect us immediately and directly, it is indicative of the challenges that we face as a region within the Colorado River Basin.
I want to have you both talk about this, but Dave, let me start with you. When we look at the fact that, for the most part, most of Arizona's population is in the desert, and we're in the midst of a drought, which is not a big surprise in the desert. Is this a situation where California or not, just based on Mother Nature, required cutbacks may in fact be something that Arizonans might have to get used to in the next decade or so?
Well, it's important to note that Arizona has made very significant advances in conservation across multiple sectors over the last decade, particularly in the urban and municipal sectors, where by municipal water use, for instance, in the Phoenix area, has declined by nearly 20% on a per capita basis over the last decade and a half. So we have made significant advances in that area. We still need to do more moving forward, and we need to have a robust conversation among not only the water professionals but the broader public about the potential trade-offs and the investments that we need to make to ensure that our water supply is sustainable for the next 100 years.
And that's a big, broader question, Rita, we'll have to get into. But first of all, in terms of having to cut back, do you see a time where, unless Mother Nature decides to rain us down and give us a lot of snowpack, we're going to have some cutbacks?
I think so. I think just to be prudent, I often analogize water management to turning the Queen Mary. You know, you got to think way ahead and you got to have a lot of time. And so we're telling municipal water providers today, do everything you can to maximize the use of reclaimed water, promote reduced turf facilities, engage in low water use plantings. In fact, that's a requirement in any public area in what we call the active management areas, which is where 80% of the state's population resides. So we have been very targeted on where we could be most effective in managing our water use. And the most important thing is, with the passage of the Groundwater Management Act, what we did is we prioritized the use of surface water and effluent over the use of groundwater. So we are protecting our groundwater supplies. It's the retirement account, if you will, in the water world, so that when that drought reduces surface water supplies, we can turn on the wells.
Mm-hmm. Rita, what do you say to people who are from outside the valley and outside Arizona who say, I don't understand how Arizona could actually be prepared for something considering it's a desert? How significant was it that Arizona started to at least look into these things more than three decades ago?
You know, sometimes the handicap that you have is a blessing. People early on, you know, in territorial days, understood that we were in a desert environment and that droughts were just a way of life. So they began planning from day one. And we, I think, have a culture of conservation. We can do better. There's no doubt. I agree with Dave on that point, absolutely. But the fact that we understand we're in a desert, we started to do things when we had excess water supplies available, like the groundwater bank, in which we began in 1995 diverting our unused Colorado River water into aquifers in Maricopa County, Pinal County, and Pima County. We've stored 4 million acre-feet of water underground in anticipation of the dry days to come.
And give us an idea. When we always hear about acre-feet, 4 million acre-feet is how many households, how many years?
Well, an acre-foot of water is basically a football field of water 1 foot deep, can typically serve five families, so it can do quite well.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix with Rita McGuire, former director of the Arizona Department of Water Resources. Now she's a practicing water attorney. Also with us is Dave White, senior sustainability scientist at ASU's Global Institute of Sustainability. He's also co-director of the Decision Center for a Desert City. Dave, let's come back to that big thing you talked about stakeholders and people being on the same page and moving forward. Where's the leadership on this issue? Are you feeling like elected leaders, business leaders are listening to the scientists about this?
You know, that's a really good point and something that I have seen exceptional progress in the last few years, where we have seen leadership emerging not only from the Arizona Department of Water Resources and the professional water resources management staff within the cities, but we're also seeing greater attention from our political leaders, those like Mayor Stanton in Phoenix, as well as Senator, now retired Senator Kyle, and Senator Flake are all doing things to continue to promote a conversation about our water future. So there is an important role for leadership in this, because we want to be proactive and not reactive. We want people to understand the situation and to plan for the future rather than reacting to crises. And that takes political leadership. I'll give you just two examples. One was the recently signed agreement for water sharing between the city of Phoenix and the city of Tucson. It allows Tucson to utilize some of Phoenix's excess surface water supplies to recharge their aquifer, in return for Phoenix having the opportunity to draw off of Tucson's surface water allocation in future years. This is a very creative and innovative institutional arrangement that plays to the advantages of each of those cities. The second example would be the Central Arizona Project, along with other western states, agreeing to bank water within the reservoir during the time period of 2014 to 2017 to try to keep that reservoir level above the critical threshold, which would trigger a shortage sharing agreement to come into play. So those are two examples of leadership that we've seen, which in my mind are new and innovative approaches.
Now, Rita, you've been involved in politics and water for a long time, and Dave cites municipalities, and he cites folks at the federal level, former Senator Kyle and Senator Flake. What about at the state level? When we hear, I don't hear a lot about that in a legislative session, about planning for water use. Is there stuff going on behind the scenes we should know about?
There's lots of conversations going on behind the scenes. The Arizona Department of Water Resources is holding a drought preparedness conference. There are lots of discussions among the state agencies, and there are more than one. The Department of Environmental Quality is also involved in this issue, looking at how we can manage our supplies in a cooperative fashion. Dave cites some good examples. I mentioned earlier the Arizona Water Bank Authority. Now, that was state legislation, and it was spearheaded by then-Governor Symington and then Speaker Mark Killian, who understood very quickly, got to act. We can't wait for the money to be available, and you know we have the time. There's a moment in time when there are water supplies available on that system. Take advantage of it. And now today we don't have those same water supplies available to bank, but we were the classic ant putting our food supplies away in advance of tougher times.
And one quick question before we go to break: state budget cuts, of course, have been in the news constantly as the state battles another deficit. And there have been major cutbacks at the State Department of Water Resources. Is that something where, if we come back, we get a surplus, whatever it is, more money needs to be devoted to that?
Yes, I absolutely agree with that. And Senator Kyle has championed that as well. DWR is a very important institution. That knowledge, that history of understanding water management is really important. And when we lose it, it slows them down. They're not as responsive. And they can't build the groundwater models, the surface water systems that let us know how to plan better for the future. Mm-hmm.
Dave, a brief response on that as well. What do you think about having a state agency that is spending more time on that and more energy?
Oh, I think it's absolutely critical. The Department of Water Resources was essentially gutted during the impact of the recession. Their employees were significantly reduced. Their budget was significantly reduced. And importantly, they lost a lot of field staff, a lot of people who work outside in the rural areas of the state. We've been focused mostly on our conversations about what we call the active management areas, which is where the majority of our population lives and the majority of our management is focused. But it's important also to remember that the rural areas of the state have a different set of circumstances, and DWR's field personnel were eliminated largely during the previous budget cuts. And that agency, while they've begun to respond and rebound to some degree, it's important to try to get that agency back up to full staff.
That's Dave White. Also here with us for the conversation is Rita McGuire. We'll talk more about Arizona and water coming up on Here and Now. Also, stay tuned. We'll talk with Arizona State University Athletic Director Ray Anderson.
KJZZ is supported by Maricopa Corporate College, providing a single point of contact for Arizona employers for market-relevant, customized solutions and training programs. More information at maricopacorporate.com.
Good morning. This is Here and Now on KJZZ. Checking Valley traffic right now on I-17 southbound. There's a crash blocking three lanes at McDowell Road. You're going to want to stay right to get by there. Around the state right now, it's sunny and 79 degrees in Tucson, 75 in Casa Grande, 74 in Yuma, it's 51 in Prescott, and 46 in Flagstaff. Stay with us here on KJZZ today at 1 for NewsHour from the BBC, and the world is at 2. While KJZZ staff members listen to Morning Edition just like you, over the next few weeks we'll share our favorite stories from Morning Edition. Visit KJZZ.org and click on I Like This Story, or visit KJZZ's Facebook page to share your comments. Mostly sunny skies in Phoenix right now, and it's 77 degrees at 11:20.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. A few more minutes left in our conversation about water in Arizona with Rita McGuire, former director of the Arizona Department of Water Resources and now a practicing water attorney. Also, Dave White, senior sustainability scientist at ASU's Global Institute of Sustainability. He's also co-director of the Decision Center for a Desert City. Rita, drought, we're hearing about it a lot. We're hearing about the impact of it, also climate change in the future. Who knows what will happen there. But as the resources become more scarce, what are some of the negative impacts of that on top of the obvious reasons?
Well, you want to make sure that you don't make snap decisions. It's really easy when you're in a dry period to say, gosh, why are we farming in a desert environment? But in fact, agriculture provides a very important cushion to municipal water users because you can turn around and pay the farmer not to divert his water supply or not to turn on his pumps. He's kept whole, but at the same time, that water supply now is diverted for municipal use. But if you've built large cities and there's no flexibility in the system, when that drought reduces the available surface water supplies, you have nowhere to go.
Mm-hmm. Dave, are there certain technologies we should be talking about that are creating greater efficiencies, things that you think are promising?
Well, certainly we have seen a rapid adoption of water-efficient technologies in the home. And so particularly new homes and remodeled homes, when people flip homes, they tend to focus on things like kitchens and bathrooms. When they do that, they tend to put in new appliances, and those tend to be very water efficient. So we've seen really good strides in technology inside the home. One area where I would like to see some innovation and some increased use of technology is in metering and monitoring the water use, particularly at the household level. Currently, the customers for water services departments have only 12 data points a year. They get one bill each month, and that bill tends to tell them only their total water supply or their total water consumption and the cost. It doesn't split that into indoor or outdoor. There's no ability to monitor your water consumption on a daily basis and respond, as we have seen some innovations in that space within the energy sector. So I'd like to see some technological innovation that allow individuals to be able to make more informed choices, understanding their own water use patterns and how to reduce water use in a way that maximizes the efficiency of their household.
Rita, what are your thoughts on that?
I think those are all very prudent, and they are the way of the future. People always ask us whether we're going to run out of water, and my response is no. Technology will provide the answers to us. We are going to be able to manage through the dry times, but it's going to require innovation, creativity, investment in alternate supplies, new science that'll make water supplies affordable that in the past were not.
It might seem obvious living in a desert that the general public would know about this. Do you think the public realizes that, hey, you know what, water doesn't just come around and we can use as much as we want for as long as we want?
Oh, I become a very popular person in the cocktail circuit the minute they know that I have any background in water. And the first question is, are we going to run out of water? So I think people are concerned about it. They don't really understand how the water gets to their tap, but they know it's precious. They know they need to conserve it.
Dave, what are your thoughts on that?
Yes, I think similarly when at cocktail parties, I get the same question. And what I try to do is to encourage the people not to think about that question, will we run out of water and when will we run out of water? Because I think it's sort of a dead-end conversation. I think the more important conversation is how do we choose to invest the water resources that we do have, to think deliberately. We have a system that has developed over the last 100-plus years that has, you know, aspects of municipal use, industrial, agricultural use, water for the environment. We need to think much more deliberately about how we're using our water to support each of those benefits that are provided to our society. Rita mentioned the discussion about agriculture being somewhat of a buffer where we can divert that water when necessary. I think it's really important for us to foster a conversation about what's the appropriate role for agriculture. It still uses more than two-thirds of the water consumed within the state. How should that agricultural sector look as we move forward? Should we focus on food crops, commodity crops, agriculture along the river, agriculture in the central part of the state? These are all questions that have been posed, and we need to think about them in a deliberate and transparent way.
We have less than a minute to go, Sarita. I'm going to give you the final answer on this one. And it's sort of a big philosophical question. But from your point of view, do you think we're going to have to make big policy shifts, or can there be incremental changes as we go ahead? Big policy or incremental?
Incremental. The big policy discussions occurred 30 years ago, and of course there are new generations of it, so I don't want to dismiss it. But we have been sort of on high alert for many, many years. We continue to have the dialogue. I think we're moving into the next generation of discussions, and I think more and more of the population is engaged in those discussions.
Rita McGuire, former director of the Arizona Department of Water Resources, now a practicing water attorney. Rita, thank you so much.
Thank you, Steve.
And Dave White, senior sustainability scientist at ASU's Global Institute of Sustainability. He's also co-director of the Decision Center for a Desert City. Dave, thank you for the time.
Thank you, Steve.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. The state budget for the next fiscal year signed by Governor Doug Ducey includes about $100 million in cuts to Arizona's three public universities. One of the loudest critics has been Mark Killian, chair of the Arizona Board of Regents. He even told us that the legislature's proposed cuts, which were approved by the governor, were some of the craziest things he's seen in his decades of involvement in Arizona government. Then last week, Killian was appointed by Governor Ducey to be the director of Arizona's Department of Agriculture. Some people say Killian's a great choice. Others wonder about the timing. With me for a few minutes to possibly help us read between the lines is Chris Hurstom, former legislative leader, also former member of the Board of Regents. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Steve.
Does this seem like strange timing to you? Does it make you wary of possible other moves?
Yes. Let me just say that I was a freshman legislator in the House of Representatives in 1983, and part of that freshman class was Mark Killian. So I have known Mark for decades, and he is a heck of a nice guy and a great public servant and really cares about the future of this state. Having said that, though, I do believe that there is a huge perception problem here. Killian, his family has a 100-year farming history in Arizona. He was under consideration for the agriculture directorship under the Brewer administration. For some reason, then they did not choose to fill that vacancy. The agriculture community in Arizona strongly supports Killian because he's qualified for the position. But he's also chairman of the Board of Regents and has been a harsh critic of the governor and legislature's budget cuts this year. And I just think that it's going to be very difficult for anyone, as well as Killian, to, while serving at the pleasure of the governor, to be comfortable in criticizing publicly your new boss. And that is the situation that he could very well be in. So there is a perception problem that he might not be able to do both jobs. And I will also tell you, since I also served on the Board of Regents, it's very time-consuming. And I also was a state agency director in the mid-'90s. And I can tell you that your ability to be a regent at the same time as being an agency director is very difficult. So that may, in a sense, make him have to come to the decision 6 months or a year from now. Can he do both, and which job would he give up? And if he gives up the regent's job, which is not a paid job,
right,
then you have this whole perception issue. Is that how the Ducey administration won, in a sense, by getting a critic out of the Board of Regents and having him, because of the time-consuming cabinet position that he holds? So if nothing else, there's a perception problem, and I think it's going to be a perception problem that's going to stick with Killian for the next couple of years.
And is he potentially putting his fellow regents in a tough position in the sense that, well, even if he were to leave, others can critique it? As you said, he's been out front on this. He's been the chair. Is he sort of forcing other regents to say something? And if they don't, does it make the budget cuts seem less significant to the general public?
Yes, I think you're right. Now, Regent Rick Myers, who was chairman of the Regents before Killian, he has very publicly, through columns and so forth, been critical of the budget cuts as well. Those have been the two individuals on the Regents that have spoken out the most against the governor and the legislative Republican legislature budget cuts to the universities. And, you know, maybe Myers would pick up that mantle, but he, you know, his term will be ending soon. Killian still has 3 years left on his term. I just think it puts Killian in an awkward position where he's always going to be looked at a little differently now. Is he pulling his punches because he's now in the governor's cabinet? And I think that perception issue causes a problem. I don't know of any regent, I may be wrong here, but I don't know in modern times of any regent that has also held a state government position, a cabinet post. I will tell you, it's interesting. Eileen Klein is the president CEO of the Regents. Let's not forget that Governor Brewer, she was chief of staff for Governor Brewer, and while she was chief of staff, Governor Brewer appointed her to the K-12 State Board of Education, and she served simultaneously. So you could sort of say there might be a precedent there. But that's the closest that I've seen any example of coming to where a regent has worked for the state and tried to be an independent regent at the same time. Let me just remind you that those regent terms are 8 years.
Yeah.
Ooh, 8 long years. And you usually, almost always, you outlive, politically speaking, you outlive the governor that appointed you. So it's usually always a mixture of gubernatorial appointed people. You know, if Killian did leave early because of this new job, it would give Ducey the opportunity also to appoint somebody right away that would probably be more supportive of his budget.
Chris, one more question related to perception. I mean, Governor Ducey's only been in office for about 3.5 months at this point. Some of his staff members have not worked in state government. Others, of course, have. Does this indicate a tin ear in some sense that right after Mark Killian's making these criticisms, then we found a position for him, whether he's qualified for it or not? It just sounds as if they weren't thinking about the perception, or they don't really care about the perception.
I think it's the latter. Okay. If you're thinking about the perception, you don't make the appointment. Okay. Or you wait at least a few months and let things settle down a little bit. The fact that they would do it the very same within 24 hours of the governor's first appearance at a regents meeting, and then he sits there with the chairman, and then the very next day it's announced that the chairman is the head of an agency and is part of his cabinet, I think it sort of shows they don't really care about that perception. You know, as I said, I think there is a perception problem. The very fact that you've contacted me and want to talk about this on Here and Now tells us something.
And the Arizona Republic, of course, had an editorial about it this morning as well on their op-ed page. So it's obviously something people are talking about.
Right.
Chris, finally, less than a minute or so to go. With all these changes, with all these cuts going on, what do you think the future of the public university system is in Arizona?
Well, I really believe that for fiscal and political reasons, that the Ducey administration is not going to be supportive of meaningful university investment. He basically has told them, you're going to have to find funding on your own. I think our governor will not be supportive of traditional neighborhood public K-12 education investment and university investment. Why? Because I think it does not fit into the Ducey, Scott Walker political agenda of running government. And running against government and running against teacher unions and liberal universities. That's just the philosophical approach, I think, to the new administration, and they may very well believe deeply in this. I think a new independent higher education political strategy is needed, but it will be at odds with the Ducey, President Biggs shrink government position, and it has to be, or state taxpayer funding of the universities is going to disappear. So the question is whether a majority of the Board of Regents wants to be independent of the Ducey administration and become aggressive by either lawsuits or perhaps an initiative to get separate funding. And they need to decide all this very soon before Ducey region appointments complicate their decision-making efforts. And they also need to be very careful, frankly, of political advisors that desperately want to get along with the new governor. The go-along to get-along mentality will no longer work for public higher education in this statement, in this state. And an investment in public education is going to really determine Arizona's future. So ABOR and our universities are really at a crossroads. Will the desire to get along with a new gubernatorial administration prevent higher education from being bold? And as a concerned Arizona citizen and a former regent, I hope not.
Chris Hurstam, former legislative leader, also, as you mentioned, former member of the Board of Regents. Chris, thank you as always. Take care.
My pleasure.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Earlier this month, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints held its general conference. Most of the conference was predictable and not especially newsworthy, but one element was surprising to many: the presence of a few attendees who actually stood up to express their opposition. One of those people is a Mesa resident who said church leaders need to make room for Mormons who have serious questions and doubts, and not only tell them to read more scripture. With me for a few minutes to talk about the significance of the opposition and what it could signify is Kristen Moulton, reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. Kristen, thank you for being with us.
You're welcome. It's fun to be there. Here, wherever we are.
We're here, there, and everywhere. So how significant is it that a group of people actually stood up and publicly declared their opposition?
You know, it's significant in one way and not significant at all in another. It is significant in that it hardly ever happens. I'm told that over the years, a few times people have raised their hands in opposition, but haven't really been noticed. But it's been, you know, decades, 1970s and 80s, since there was any attention on opposing votes. So it's significant in that way, in that it's unusual. As far as having any broad effect, mm-hmm. I don't think it's significant. And it probably means nothing to the vast majority of Mormons who attend conferences.
So what could happen potentially to the people who said they were opposed? And do we know exactly what they were opposed to? Were there certain issues that came up and that's why they stood up? Or is it more of a general disagreement?
To answer the latter part of your question first. So these people say that they have all kinds of different issues. For some, it is that problematic doctrine or history of the church. For others, it's more the church's opposition to same-sex marriage. For others, it might be the church's refusal to ordain women to the priesthood. So it's all over the map. They kind of came together on the internet, and they're disaffected in different ways. So they say they have diverse reasons for their opposition. Mm. So, and you ask what would happen to them. You
right.
know, it's hard to know. I think some of them are already on their way to resigning their membership in the church. Others are sort of waiting to happen to see what the church will do. They were told after their vote to contact their local church leaders, which some of those that I've spoken to said they had already done. Mm. But they'll do it. I suppose they'll do what they were directed to do and have those conversations, and it may or may not lead to excommunication, or they may just remove their names from the rolls. But I suspect that those who are very visible and very public about it will soon not be Mormons anymore.
Kristen, the LDS Church recently worked with gay rights groups on an anti-discrimination statute. The church also got some attention here in Arizona for what was considered to be a fairer sort of immigration enforcement kind of package, different from Arizona's SB 1070. Does that indicate some kind of change in how the church is expressing itself in some very public issues?
You know, I don't think it's so much a change as just expressing itself on these public issues. You know, until an issue comes to the fore, it isn't really, the church's response isn't really articulated, and both of those issues have come to the fore in law, you know, in culture and law. So I think it's more the church delineating or answering these public policy issues, these cultural issues for the first time, and, you know, figuring out a way that can be compatible with church doctrine and teaching and practice, and also fulfill other, you know, missions of the church, like compassion toward immigrants and compassion toward people with discrimination against them because of same-sex relationships.
This may be a tough one to answer based on just the general conference situation, but I'm sort of coming off that question to the broader sense of, do church leaders, or at least a majority of them, seem to believe the faith or how the church is run needs to evolve in order, I'm going to say to survive, but to really thrive instead of not surviving, but really to excel going forward?
Did you say, are you asking if I think most Mormons think that?
Yeah, I actually asked it as most church leaders, but I don't know, either way would be, I don't know what your thoughts are on that.
No, I don't think they do think that. I don't think that they believe that their thriving depends on succumbing to public pressure or cultural pressure. I don't think they think that. I think they believe what they believe, and they want to make sure the church's mission to be compassionate comes through, but also not to bend on what they believe their doctrine is. So, you know, unlike some other churches, Christian churches that have very much adapted with the times, a lot of the mainline Protestant churches have done that. Most of them have seen their numbers declining. So I don't think that any church would look at that as a wise approach to whatever culture says you should do is what you should do. The churches that have done that mostly are declining in number in terms of membership. So, you know, I don't know that they even look at that kind of evidence out there, but I really don't think they think that their thriving depends on bending. I think they realize that their thriving depends on keeping Mormons Mormon. And that's why the church is aggressively going after anybody who's out there publicly criticizing. Any Mormon who's out there criticizing their church is likely to face a disciplinary hearing. So I think they do worry about that. You know, we all know that the Mormon church is extremely public relations centered. It's very conscious of its image. So in that way, I think maybe you're onto something that they do care. They care a lot about their image.
Yes.
But I don't think they're likely to start fundamentally changing doctrines to accommodate cultural change.
Kristen Moulton, reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. Kristen, thank you very much for the time.
You're welcome. It was fun.
KJZZ is supported by SRP, providing over 150 education grants last year to schools in our community, creating a foundation for future scientists, engineers, technicians, and tradespeople. More at srp4edu.com.
Good morning, it's KJZZ's Here and Now on 91.5 FM and on the web at kjzz.org. Well, it'll be a nice day to be outside in the valley if you don't mind a little wind. Our high expected to be 87 degrees and dropping to 78 tomorrow. On I-17 right now, southbound, the three right lanes are blocked by a crash at McDowell Road. Mostly sunny skies in Phoenix and 77 degrees at 11:44.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. A new men's basketball coach was hired last week. The football team held its spring game on Friday in front of an enthusiastic crowd, and the baseball team is ranked in the top 10. That's the current condition of some of the major sports at Arizona State University. Where has that momentum come from, and can it continue, or is this still a pro sports town? With me to talk about that is Ray Anderson, Vice President of Athletics at ASU. Anderson was a player agent and National Football League executive before he arrived at ASU early in 2014. Ray, first of all, how important was the hiring of Bobby Hurley as ASU's head men's basketball coach? Do you expect him to be here a long time, or if he succeeds, is ASU a stepping stone? Does any of that matter?
ASU is no stepping stone for anyone, and we make it very clear when we're talking to head coaches potentially coming in here that this is a place that they should view as a place where they can come in and on a long-term basis put their imprint on a program, help us build a program of which they and this community and this university will be proud for a number of years. And so if we get any inclination during the course of the interview process, Steve, in the course of the discussion, that anyone is viewing this as a stepping stone, then they are immediately eliminated from consideration, because we know this is a place where if you come with the right attitude and the right support, which we will give, we can build championship caliber teams, and that's what we're all about. And Bobby Hurley is someone who completely understood and embraced that approach and philosophy, and we're happy to have him. We're honored to have him, and you know what? He's fortunate to be here as well.
Tell us a little bit more about his background. A lot of us in my age group, of course, remember him as a great player at Duke, and then his NBA career was derailed by an accident. His dad is a well-known high school coach, but he's only been a head coach for a couple of years. What did you see in him that indicated to you he's ready for this big opportunity?
Well, I think you alluded to it. His dad was a 30-year high school coach, continues to coach, and not just any high school coach. He's in the Naismith Hall of Fame, Basketball Hall of Fame, as a high school coach, who has won 27 state championships in New Jersey in his 30-plus years. Bobby Hurley and his brother Dan grew up in that environment. And so the amount of basketball education and acumen and exposure that they got is a lifetime of experience. And then, of course, he goes on to Duke and plays very successfully at a championship level for Coach K, including two national championships, All-American status, and the Final Four MVP 1 year. And then, of course, he plays 5 years in the NBA and does so for 3 or 4 years after a horrific accident, which shows you how badly he wants to play and be involved in the game. And then he joins his brother for, I think it was a year at Wagner, 2 years at Rhode Island, and then the 2 years very successfully at Buffalo. You put all of that together, and the body of work in our minds definitely unequivocally convinced us that he could be a head coach at this level very successfully, and he's got the passion and the will to build and do it at this level, Steve, and that's why Bobby Hurley was our guy.
What is it about the ASU men's basketball program specifically that has made it hard to be a consistent winner?
Because I don't think there's been a real commitment from the university and from the administration to really be an elite program. It was a kind of an environment whereby so long as they were okay and didn't embarrass the university, that was acceptable. That's no longer the case. We expect all of our programs, and certainly men's basketball, to be competitive, vying for championships with first-class student athletes. We expect them to aspire to be Pac-12 and national championships. And if you don't have that mindset, you're not going to be here. So we've changed the expectation. We've changed the culture expectation.
For ASU to be as successful as you want it to be and expect it to be, is this a university that has to attract top recruits along with the guys who will stay for 3 or 4 years and sort of build on that? Because we saw, of course, in the finals of this year, we saw the example of Duke, which has done it both ways over the years, and then Wisconsin, which primarily had players who'd been there 2, 3, 4 years.
Our model definitely is the Wisconsin, the Stanford model. We want to have student-athletes who want to be here 3 or 4 years. You may occasionally get the superstar who is a one-and-done type, and so long as that person comes in and can academically legitimately qualify, if we have one of those from time to time, we certainly will blend it the way Duke has been able to do it successfully. But our expectations is that we want a model that will build championships. That means student-athletes who want to be here for 3 or 4 years. There is a different way of doing it. It doesn't have to be the Kentucky one-and-done.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. A few more minutes left with ASU's Vice President of Athletics, Ray Anderson. Ray, how difficult is it to have an athletic program that wins, graduates student-athletes, and follows the rules? It seems like that's been a tough combination for a lot of universities.
For some universities, it has. It's not going to be an option for us because we're going to do it exactly as you say. And it's going to be our job to make sure that we are working hard enough to discover and then bring in those student-athletes who will both academically and athletically perform at a championship level and do so in an environment of complete compliance, complete ethics, complete integrity. We believe it can be done. We don't buy or subscribe to the notion that you have to cheat to be successful in intercollegiate athletics. We're going to be one of those programs that does it the right way.
Why are facilities so important when it comes to attracting recruits and also giving off that vibe that the program is a big one?
Well, you certainly want to be competitive in your game day venues. Student athletes who have choices and options certainly take their visits. And when they see that the university is investing in where they're going to be able to study and train and practice and play in its big time frontline elite facilities, that has an impact on them. So you at least have to be able to compete with your facilities. But for us, more so, facilities is about fan engagement. You have to bring them to a place where they will get the entertainment and the affinity that they won't get by staying home in their super-duper men caves. So you have to bring them to a facility where they have technology and they have easy access. And I'm not talking about just more restrooms and concessions, but the whole game day experience has to be really something unique. So you have to, and we are in this reinvention of the stadium, very focused on making a game day experience unlike any they've had before in this area.
Ray, there was a perception that alumni weren't as excited about certain programs. Have you seen that change? Have you noticed people are receptive to the ideas you're having? Because obviously a lot of this comes down to fundraising, frankly.
I am very encouraged because not just in football, but you see it in basketball, certainly on the women's side. Just in the last week, very frankly, there's been a lot of upgraded interest in our men's basketball. You see what's happening with baseball with the move over to Phoenix Muni. Our wrestling program under Zeke Jones has gotten a real boost from donors and boosters. Our swimming and diving program, we are seeing movement from fans and potential donors to say it's not just football and basketball. There's a lot of other sports that you are offering that we want to step up and participate in.
Ray, finally, this is a place that has the four major professional sports. Do you have to compete with these pro sports programs? But you want to be something more than a niche, clearly. How do you make that work?
We're distinct here, actually, because we are the collegiate sports programs in this space in Phoenix, Tempe, Scottsdale. And a lot of folks love the collegiate game even more so than the professional game. So we don't see the professional teams here as competitors, per se. We'd like to think of them really as complementary partners and would love to be able to do some things jointly with them and certainly have the attitude and the philosophy that we want to work with the professional teams here. But we don't see them as competition. We certainly don't fear them because we think the offerings that we are able to provide as the college program in town is very, very unique. And we are going to be excited about the way forward coexisting with the professional teams here.
Ray Anderson is Vice President of Athletics at Arizona State University. Ray, thank you for fitting us in.
My pleasure, Steve.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. It's not only since Arizona became a state that it has been part of stories that seem unbelievable and maybe or maybe not true. Unofficial historian Bob Bowes-Bell, executive editor of True West magazine, reveals some of those tales in his new book, True West Moments, Where Truth is Stranger Than Fiction. And Bell also illustrated the book. Bob, welcome. So I'm wondering about the subtitle, Where Truth is Stranger Than Fiction. A lot of people will say, yeah, in Arizona, of course it is. But in general, have you found that to be as obvious as it should be?
You know, it never ceases to amaze me how crazy our history is and how strange it is. Just to give you one example, Apache is not an Apache word. I think that is pretty crazy, and yet it's absolutely true. when the Spaniards were, the conquistadors were coming through this area, they stopped at Zuni, and a whole bunch of renegade Indians stole their horses. And they said, and they were incredulous, and they said to the Zuni, "Who are those guys?" And the Zuni said, "Enemies." And it sounded like Apache to the Spaniards, and so they started calling them Apaches. And the Apaches never heard the word. It was not an Apache word. So I just think that is so ridiculous. But then virtually everyone in Arizona, if you're indigenous, was named by their enemies. The Pima were asked who their neighbors were, and they said as a joke, the Bean Eaters, which became Papago, and the Navajos were asked who built the ancient Pueblos, and they said enemies, ancient enemies, and that came out as Anasazi. And then the Pima themselves were asked all kinds of questions by the Europeans, and they kept saying Pima, which means I don't know. They called them the Pima, which is the I don't know tribe. Pretty strange. I don't think you could make that up, do you?
No. And what does this say about cleaning up our history? Is it better to figure these things out as we go along?
You know, I think that it's we should just note it. We should just note that, as Mark Twain says, once you realize we're all crazy, everything makes sense.
Bob, let's look at a couple of the other stories from True West Moments. The one that comes to mind for me, I guess people know about Sholo, but can you tell that story, Sholo versus a straight flush?
Yeah, this is a wonderful story. As the story goes, there was two ranchers, Cordy and Cooley and Marion Clark, and they decided that the valley they lived in wasn't big enough for the both of them. And so they played a card game on July 4th, 1876, to see who would stay and then who would have to split. And allegedly they sat down and played 7-up, which was a popular game the Cowboys played, and the lowest card in that game wins. So while dealing the cards, Mr. Clark said, "Mr. Cooley, if you can show low, you win." And Cooley turned over the deuce of clubs, and he replied, "Show low it is." And the local residents there are just thankful that he didn't call for a straight flush.
I guess when we think about flushing these days, we're thinking about gallons of water. This leads me to the 10-gallon hat. How did that get its name?
Well, I always thought growing up when people say, "Oh, that's a 10-gallon hat," but that's what the hat would hold, or maybe it was an of water, just 10 gallons, or that maybe it was an exaggeration that hat is so big that it could hold 10 gallons. But it actually is probably a corruption of a Spanish term, which is tangalan. And as the sombreros in down Mexico way got more elaborate at the turn of the century and the end of the Mexican Revolution, people would say to a vaquero, they would say, "What is your hat?" And he would say, "Tangalan," which is, it's a very elegant hat. You would say, "Tangalan sombrero."
Mm.
And so probably someone in Texas, I'm guessing this, probably turned that, mangled that into 10 gallons, or did it as a joke. And so 10-gallon actually probably comes from tangalan.
Bob, you're someone, you wrote a memoir of sorts with growing up along Route 66 and growing up in Kingman. When did these stories start to really resonate with you, and why did they stick with you? Because a lot of folks will say, "Oh, I heard this great story as a kid," or "I wanted to be an artist as a kid," and then, I don't know, civilization or society knocks it out of us. How did it stick with you?
You know, that's a great question, because I was obviously obsessed, like every baby boomer boy, with being a cowboy, and loved Westerns on TV. But then in the 60s, I heard the siren of rock and roll music and girls fast cars and stuff, and I kind of left it behind. But I had more than a passing interest in it. But one day in 1989, my mother gave me a Christmas gift of The Saga of Billy the Kid, a used book. And I thought, I know this story, and I opened it up, and the first line is, "John Chisholm knew pals." And I was just hooked. I sat there, and my kids were playing in their wrappings, and they went to bed, and it was 2 o'clock in the morning, and I put that book down, and I said, "You know what? I was born to do this. I love the Old West, and I want to find out everything I can, and this is how I want to express myself." So that came from that one book. And I read a quote from a guy who said that if you can capture that feeling that you had somewhere between the ages of 9 and 11 and do that, you'll probably be successful. And boy, does that fit me.
Bob, one more question about True West moments and the book. Does it help, as far as the True West moments are concerned, to really grab people's imagination with sort of the shorter version of the story? Are you hoping that, hey, people will hit themselves and say, wow, that's a great story? Or are you also hoping that it sort of whets their appetite to dig in deeper?
Yes. Now, here's a little secret I've never told anybody, but I often will just go into my archives and find a drawing and then go back the story in and go, you know, that could go with Apache's not an Apache word. You know what I mean? I do drawings that I like, and then I'll back in the story. And the idea is, yes, to hook people and to hopefully get them to go, you know, I'd like to find out more.
Bob Bozbell, former radio star, also the man behind True West magazine. His new book is True West Moments, Where Truth is Stranger Than Fiction. Bob's got a couple of book signings coming up Saturday in Apache Junction, Sunday at noon at Western Spirit Scottsdale's Museum of the West. Bob, thanks as always.
It's always a pleasure to talk to you, Steve.
And that's all for today's edition of KJZZ's Here and Now. Thanks to senior producer Sarah Ventry and Bruce Drummond for their help. And thank you for listening. You can catch today's segments or our past programs online at kjzz.org. Now it's time for NPR's Here and Now on listener-supported KJZZ-FM Phoenix in HD. I'm Steve Goldstein. Have a great afternoon.